up, y'all? Welcome to the Stormcrow Comic Cast, Volume 2, Issue 6. I'm Ruben G.
I'm Kevin Merrill.
And we're here to finish up, to wrap up the awesome first volume of Saga.
Yes, it's coming to a close. And kind of, you know, not to skip to the end, but in a very interesting way that'll kind of make you want to continue with Volume 2.
Yeah, hopefully
it wraps up super well. Yeah. Nice little cliffhanger type moment, of course. Right. But yeah,
another one of those emotional cliffhangers, yes, as opposed to danger.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Which Brian K. Vaughan's been doing fairly well, as we've seen in previous issues. But yeah, what a awesome journey up to this point.
Yeah.
But we're starting off with the return of, oh, and of course, adult themes. We're still talking about Saga. So keep that in mind when you're listening. Once again, unlike the last issue, we have narrations from Hazel. Yeah. They're back. So
I was trying to think of a good reason why the narrations were absent last issue, and I really don't have any. I'm wondering if there was a time constraint or whether he just
forgot.
But it was just sort of weirdly absent. But of course, the first page, we do get Hazel back. Once upon a time, each of us was somebody's kid.
No.
And the scene of Elena and Marco trying to make their way to the rocket ship forest, surrounded by sort of, you know, it looks like the American West, the Grand Canyon. There's butts and it's kind of desert looking and steps and such.
Yeah. And it looks like Hazel keeps pinching Marco's neck.
Yeah.
So yeah.
She's obsessed with my neck flesh. I know her fingernails are like little hypodermics. You know, the narration continues. Everyone had a father, even if he never provided anything more than a seed. In the next panel, everyone had a mother, even if she had to leave us on a stranger's doorstep. No matter how we're eventually raised, all of our stories begin the exact same way. And, you know, a lot of this comic really, family is important in it. Obviously, right. Elena, Marco, Hazel, maybe Isabel, if you want to throw her in there. But a lot of the other characters.
The ghostly cousin.
The ghostly cousin. Prince Robot and his family, the way his soon-to-be-born child is kind of motivating him. The Will, if you want to call the stock a familial relationship with him. But,
right.
You know, certainly Lion Cat, and spoilers for the following arc, but Slave Girl. Slave Girl sort of becomes a part of the Will's family. So I just wanted to throw that out there as I was, you know, beginning this issue, and it starts with this sort of family-centered narration. I started thinking about all the different family relationships in here.
No, it's true. It's definitely definitely a valid point. Everyone seems to sort of have their own, you know, with the exception of like some of the small characters that we run into. All the main characters definitely have some sort of family unit that they're trying to maintain or grow or what
have
you.
It's motivating what they do.
Exactly, you
know?
Yeah.
They find the rocket ship forest, and it is not looking good. Devastated landscape, broken trees, stumps, sort of a foggy, ashy look to the landscape. Yeah. It sort of reminds me, if you've been up the mountains and seen some parts of the forest that have been hit with acid rain, and it's like these stalks or splinters just sort of dotting the landscape. And that's what they find. But
Isabel
is not as it seems. Yeah. And Isabel explains.
Yeah, Isabel pops up. Evening, boss, what a miss. And at this point, Elena is just completely just shut down. She says, it's over, Isabel. And she replies, what are you talking about? You two wanted to find the rocket ship forest, right? Well, here you go. And Marco goes on to say, you know, this isn't a forest, it's a graveyard, which Isabel says, it depends on how you look at it, really. Are you on drugs? Whatever used to grow here was all slashed and burned ages ago. And Isabel goes, you know, you lifers believe everything you see. Us floaty types are masters of misdirection, remember? You really think we wouldn't hide a few saplings? Your girl has no idea how lucky she is. And right as she says that in that particular last panel of the page, there's this huge shadow that kind of...
out of nowhere, it just casts itself across the face of Elena and Marco. And they sort of look up and turn the page. And
you have like a sideways splash that you sort of have
to
turn the book clockwise.
And the rocket ship itself it's obviously organic. It's a tree, but it doesn't sort of rustle out at the top like a sprig of broccoli or a common tree or whatever. But it is more pointy, and it's sort of has spires. It kind of reminds me of a cathedral in a way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's got this sort of door on the front that appears to be some kind of lattice work or something like that. But, you know, about low enough to the ground for them to climb in, it appears.
Yeah, and it's just kind of a great piece of art in general, this page. Yeah. You know, you got the two moons in the background, yeah, and all the great, you know, sort of shadow work going on and different shading elements and things of that sort. It's really, really well done.
Yeah, absolutely.
And even Isabel, even though she's off in the distance, you can still kind of see through her a little bit too.
Part of the that's right.
The rocket ship tree, yeah, behind her.
I would have killed for a treehouse when I was a kid.
And what an awesome treehouse that would be to have.
Yes, my treehouse. We had a couple of them, actually. None of them took flight.
No.
I'm very disappointed in retrospect.
We, I think we all as kids had the budget edition.
Yeah, that's that was, right. So scene change. Back to Cleve and the dead body of the stock all curled up like a dead spider typically would be, and McHenry, you know, sort of consoling, or not really consoling, but assuring Prince Robot that she's got his back on the paperwork. It was a good shoot, Your Majesty. That freelancer drew on you first. I'll back you up in the after action 100%. And so, you know, they're looking over the body and starting to get past what just happened and think about the future. Right. When a voice comes out of the stocks, little Easter egg phone, which McCall still gripped loosely in her dead hand.
Yeah.
And it's the Will continuing to talk with her. You remember at the end of last issue, the Will was sort of pleading to get back in the stock's good graces,
right,
get a part of the mission so he could scoop up some money, mm-hmm, and possibly pay
repair
off
their relationship too, possibly.
Yeah, yes, certainly. I'm sure that hopefully would have happened in his eyes. But he doesn't realize what's happened. Now, in that sort of final couple of pages, when Prince Robot 4 actually shoots the stock, mm-hmm, it is a big yellow energy blast coming out of his Mega Man cannon. And what I'm realizing is, as the Will talks, you know, he's off in the Space Onion, who knows where, outside of Sextillion, I would imagine.
Right.
And he doesn't realize that anything's happened, just that there's, you know, the stock hasn't said anything. He's like, hey, you still there? I know you're ticked off, but hear me out. I need your help with the girl. And he sort of gives her a brief rundown, not realizing that she's dead. So perhaps the cannon didn't make any sound, you know, didn't go through the phone. The phones seem to be, you know, reasonable quality.
Right.
You know, but he didn't hear. And
now that sort of is an interesting idea, because it was a big blast that happened. But if it was silent somehow.
Yeah. And there's no sound effect drawn on that panel when the shot actually goes off.
Just sort of the ray of light or whatever.
Yeah, from big yellow energy blast of some sort. But no sound effect, no boom or usually you're doing the sound effects. But there is no. Anyway.
Hollywood, are you listening?
That's all right. And so Prince Robot hears his voice through the phone, picks up the phone, says, hello, are you this creature's representative? And, the Will replies, the hell is this? And Prince Robot says, Prince Robot 4, of course, in a British accent, which I'm not feeling brave enough to do this morning. I'm sorry to be the bearer of unfortunate news, but your client violated protocol and was justly killed in action. And it sort of hits the Will. What did you say? I'll be taking possession of her vehicle per Article 11, but any personal effects can be forwarded to Landfall if you'd like. And the Will, just this stone-cold look in his face. I think he is sort of in shock right now. It's not quite as an emotionful expression as I would typically expect, given the circumstance. It's just a cold look. Listen to my voice, boy. I aim to murder you right after I murder everything you loved. And then he hangs up.
So he is now, without a doubt, a man on a mission for vengeance or whatever you want to say. He's Prince Robot has definitely just made an enemy.
Yes.
I think it's fair to say.
His poop list, Prince Robot is on it.
Right.
Right. And the following pages are just, you know, they're sort of silent action, just the Will sitting there grasping his head and just sort of, you know, face palming his face into his hands, you know, dealing with what he just found out. Yeah.
And I just had an idea for a movie.
Yeah.
If they ever do a saga movie, just based off this one scene alone where he's making threats over the phone. Liam Neeson needs to play the Will. He's been there before. He's done it.
Interesting.
He's prime and ready.
That's a neat idea. I'm gonna check. Maybe a little old now.
Yeah. Hollywood takes some liberties. Maybe the Will be an older guy.
That's right. And another scene change back to Elena and Marco at the rocket ship. And, sort of dealing with what they're seeing and Elena remarking, so we're taking our infant child into outer space in something made of wood. And Marco explains, actually, that some of Reith's armada used lumber, making them almost completely invisible to modern instruments.
So yeah.
There's some context for wood ships, but it is kind of funny, you know.
Sure. No, it's definitely something you don't think about. I'm going to build a rocket ship from wood. That'll definitely keep everyone intact. But no, that is kind of, I guess if it would work, that is kind of clever, because you would think that, you know, whatever instruments they're using is trying to pick up, you know, some bulk of metal out there flying around or something like that. But if it's just lumber,
my response would be like, okay, I imagine there's incredible pressures and forces out of space. So, you know, for wood, lumber, is it capable of withstanding those pressures? Yeah. But of course, Marco's people have magic.
Sure.
So
they can maybe reinforce it or whatever.
Something like that. And, have it not be detectable. So, fun and interesting. Isabel lets them know they need to make a sacrifice before they get off the ship.
Yeah. And I love the facial expression of Elena in the next panel too. Yeah, just like, you know, what more do you want from us? You know, they've come so far. Right. They're finally where they've been trying to get to this whole volume.
Yeah.
And, they're still left with one final challenge, you know, that's before right. They can finally get off of this planet.
Yeah. But the sacrifice, as Isabel informs Elena, is not for her. It is for the ship itself. You want to go someplace new? You have to show it you're willing to leave something of real value behind. And Marco puts forward his sword.
Yes. And interesting little dialogue here between Elena and Marco. She says, Marco, no, you just took out a whole platoon with that thing. Right. And then we get back to Marco's sort of surprisingly practical reasoning behind being sort of a pacifist or whatever, more so than a philosophical reason. He says, exactly, when a man carries an instrument of violence, he'll always find the justification to use it. If we really want to escape this war, we have to stop bringing it with us. And so she brings up a counterpoint, like a more sentimental argument. Right. She says, but I thought that sword's been in your family for 1,000 generations. And he kind of responds, it's still just a thing. Elena,
it's very Buddhist.
Exactly. It's just an inanimate object. It doesn't. Yeah, we've had it for a long time, but it doesn't really matter. It's just an object. And he goes, you're my family now.
Yeah. And he snaps it over his knee, which either he's really strong or I don't know what to make of it.
I think
the sword snaps.
Maybe we should bring up too that there seems to be like a bunch of like rays of light coming from the sword when he snaps it too. Yeah. Maybe breaking whatever
magical properties it may have had.
Yeah. Or, yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
And at that moment, the door to the, if you can call that a door, to the
rocket ship
opens up.
It's sort of I described it as lattice work, but in the picture here, you can see it's almost like vines untangling themselves and creating a space they can get through. And Marco steps on in. It looks pretty cool.
Yes, it does.
Inside of the rocket ship is pretty cool. It's got a foyer, as Marco comments, and a lot of colors. It's definitely got this sort of tile floor that does not appear to be organic, but then it's got plants and this sort of glowing mushrooms and ferns and trees and shrubbery within. But it's very elegant. And I love Isabel's comment here. Wait until you see the attic. This season's crop was supposedly all tricked out. And then she says, never thought I'd actually get to ride in one. So two things really quick. If she's never been in it, how does she know that the attic is worth seeing? So first of all, and then second of all, this season's crop was supposedly all tricked out.
Right.
So whoever made these rocket ships or grew them or tended them, or even if it was just the rocket ship doing itself, has some sort of ability to choose how it grows and what features it has. So I think we get our first inkling that in the sacrifice on the previous page, perhaps the whole situation, that the trees do have some magical elements to them. They seem to be maybe sentient in some way. Later on, they communicate. So kind of
spoilers.
Yeah. Minor ones. And in fact, maybe it's communicating right now, actually. Well, yeah, it's vroom, vroom, and they hear these sounds and like, what's going on? Tremors. And then Isabel points out it's not an earthquake. It's ignition.
Yeah.
So it is taking off. They are hardly in the thing. Elena's remark, we haven't even seen the control room yet. Who's steering this thing? And then, of course, Isabel awesomely using the word dude. Dude, you don't steer a rocket ship. You ride it. So who knows where they're going? They're not in absolute control.
Right. There's no steering wheel to this thing at all. That's and, right. But she does kind of, Isabel lets Elena and Marco know that even though they can't directly control where the ship is going, if the ship likes them, it might be open to suggestions.
Right.
And, Elena brings up a place called Quietus.
Yes.
Which will end up being their, I guess, their next destination. And Marco asks, you know, the old lighthouse planet, why? You're the one who said it's never too early to start thinking about a kid's education, right? I want our daughter to meet the smartest person in the universe. And as she says that, the ship is at full force going through space, I would assume, and we go back to Prince Robots.
That's right. And we don't get any clear exposition there about who she specifically means. I think, you know, attentive readers probably have a guess, and that'll be confirmed later.
Yeah.
But right now, we don't. We just know she wants to get her daughter educated.
Right.
So another scene change. We are back at the stock, as you mentioned, her ship, Prince Robot. And dude, this is another He-Man moment for me. This ship looks straight like a He-Man toy. It's kind of this, it looks, you know, vaguely like the skull or something of some sort of alien creature, and the bay doors sort of open at like a bottom jaw with these giant tusks or fangs coming out of it. But it looks like a He-Man toy to me.
And if you look in the background there behind the trees, you can kind of see like this blue skeleton type figure with an annoyingly high-pitched voice. It sounds like a really bad idea from the 80s.
Yeah. But no.
Or maybe I'm
another He-Man reference there, I guess, for all our younger listeners. And so he's Prince Robot's getting aboard the ship when he gets an incoming priority transmission from Landfall Secret Intelligence. And this little emblem appears on his screen is saying SI, so I assume that's Secret Intelligence.
Yeah.
And it's Bat Agent, Special Agent Gale with the bat wings. Calling up to check in and let him know that here is some bad news, that there's a dead freelancer out there and Prince Robot might be the reason. Looks like this causes them problems. They
right.
apparently really try not to mess with the freelancers.
They hire them for certain missions, it turns out.
That's right.
But Prince Robot sort of makes a counterpoint to that too, though, saying that, well, the Rethians also, or the Moonies, as he refers to them, also use freelancers.
Yeah,
too.
And that it looks like the mercenary he shot was actually working for them, hunting down Marco and Elena and the baby. And in fact, this is news to Special Agent Gale, who's sort of in shock, saying, Reth High Command knows about the baby? How? And Prince Robot, I have no idea, but its parents are vastly more capable than your initial analysts suggest. Marco, the father, is an effing force of nature. Yeah.
But it's the mother who really frightens me.
Yeah, as he takes out the book.
Yeah.
So it kind of interesting. And it is kind of cool because Elena and Marco have sort of dealt with some crazy junk already in just these first handful of issues. So, you know, the enemy giving them a little bit of props, a little bit of their dues.
Sure, yeah.
But we turn the page and, you know, Special Agent Gale sort of pushes him. He's like, if this was just a fact-finding expedition, maybe I'd care, but it's not. So if you want to be home in time for a certain joyous occasion, you better make sure your targets never get off Cleve alive. Understood? And kind of interesting. So he not only knows about the imminent birth of Prince Robot's child,
yeah.
but is using to sort of way. And I'm just going to throw this out here. I don't have much good to sort of support this, much good info. But remember that Prince Robot was in the act with his wife
right.
when Special Agent Gale originally first appeared in the comic. You know, this could be some ploy. I don't think they talk about it in the volumes they've already released, but maybe Special Agent Gale is making up something is, you know, made the pregnancy happen, or, you know, maybe the phone call where Princess Robot or whatever told the prince that she was, you know, with the child. Maybe that was some kind of hoax or something by Special Agent Gale, just trying to twist the arm of the robot.
Right.
I don't have much for that, but I figured I'd share it. And we do figure out what the deal is with Quietus. Of course, Prince Robot sort of in the cockpit of the Stock's former vehicle, thumbing through the Harlequin romance novel.
Elena's.
It was Elena's. And the back page, a picture of the author. D. Oswald Heist is a Looper-nominated author of over 40 novels. He resides on Quietus. So, Elena and Marco have chosen their destination, if the tree listens to them, of the author of Elena's book.
Right. Such a fangirl. Yeah. All the places she could go, she's going to stalk this guy.
Right. And the picture of the author of Heist is He's a bald old man, wonderful, awesome sort of Santa Clausy beard.
He's a Cyclops.
Yeah. It's, and, you know, eyeballs, whenever you like see them out of a human head, they always look weirdly large. I'm betting his eyeball would look freakishly large, just like a grapefruit eyeball. So.
But anyway, so he made the comment a little bit earlier saying they could literally be anywhere in the .. He turns to this page. He sees this author information, and then he goes pretty much quiet or whatever. And you just see on his visor, on his TV screen face, Quietest.
Yeah.
In
so
reverse.
he's making the leap. He's connecting the dots. And without even saying anything, it is apparent that Prince Robot does have a firm guess about where they're going.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And then we cut back to the Ruckus Ship treehouse.
Yeah.
And the narration picks back up. Hazel says, this is where I grew up. Most of my childhood was spent clinging to the feathers of a dulled arrow blindly fired across a starless night. It was heaven for a while anyway.
This middle panel, absolutely another one of those art-worthy pieces of just like, you know, buying it from Staples or whatever and putting it on your wall. And what I love about it in particular is that the quotation, even if you don't realize that it's a narration in a single panel of a comic book, even out of context, it's cool. If you came in to a room and you saw this painting of this sort of rocket ship tree or whatever, not even really knowing that's what it was, the quotation, most of my childhood was spent clinging to the feathers of a dulled arrow blindly fired across a starless night. That would be awesome art, even with the quotation in there. It actually adds more to it, I think, maybe out of context.
Yeah, out of context, it would almost, to me, would seem like maybe like a, like from a poem, maybe, or something like that.
Absolutely. I'm 100% with you. It's beautiful, but the quotation is very nice.
One of my Facebook statuses.
Yes. And so the bottom panel, Marco with a smile on his face holding up baby Hazel to the window to see into space. And, and they're saying goodbye to Cleve. And Marco asks Isabel if she'd like to say farewell as well. And her response, no offense, but nothing is more boring than people who are obsessed with their hometowns.
Right.
On to the next one, I say. And so that's another interesting thing. I wonder if that informs her background. When she was alive, was she like a military brat and had to travel a lot? Or, you know, is there something about her life that gives her that perspective?
Yeah.
And we had Elena coming out of the shower looking oh so refreshed and kind of making comments to confirm that. When everything goes blue and we find out the ship can communicate, as I mentioned earlier, and it is doing so through reverse photosynthesis. And we get a retread of a quote we heard, I think, in the first issue we've got magic incoming, which last time wasn't so good.
Right.
I mean, there were dead people after they said that.
Yeah. At this point, anytime you hear that phrase, stay on your toes.
Yeah, that's right.
Something's coming for you, you know?
That's right.
So, but anyway, they're freaking out. Elena's, you know, saying, I thought you said these ships were undetectable. Marco says they are. There's no way anyone could. And then he realizes that it was his sword.
That's right. The breaking of the sword may have alerted somebody.
Right. And Isabel's freaking out too. So even kind of our ghostly friend here is, you know, what'd you do this time? And then Marco replies, breaking the blade must have summoned her. She's probably using its hilt to follow us. God, she's going to kill me. And Elena is immediately suspicious that this is Gwendolyn.
Right.
Marco, if your ex wants her stupid rings back, just, and then
bam, the entrance.
Yes.
Two armor clad horned warriors with battle axes, one with the hilt of a sword sort of wreathed in a, goldish sort of magical flame, looking very imposing and speaking, I guess, Wreathian.
Right.
Which I did not find any easy, obvious cognates here, but they.
Estus.
Yeah. Mia Nabo, or something like that. And very cool. This next first panel of the next page, first thing is one of the two warriors sort of magically shocking Isabel, who's incorporeal, like, just blows her right away.
It's like blood splashing everywhere.
Right.
And, Elena returns fire screaming out Isabel's name. Marco's screaming out no, but I'm not sure what he's screaming out no about. Is it over the fact that Isabel was just shot, that Elena's returning fire? Does he already recognize who these two individuals are that's popped up on their ship?
Well, I think he probably recognized them immediately and maybe from the panels, you know, even knew beforehand who it was likely to be. And I think he's screaming no at the violence in general.
Okay.
You know, Isabel's just been blasted. His wife is returning fire at his parents. And I think he's just like, oh my God, this is going bad. Like, holy crap, no.
Yeah.
And Elena does hit one of the two warriors who screams and falls back. The other warrior readying his axe and charging. And here Marco does step in, speaking more Wreathian. And the Wreathian soldier with the axe says, Marco? Kutio Vervi? And Elena interjects, what the F is going on?
Right.
Marco continues pleading. I think he's saying something along the lines of, it's like Tio Estas Mio Ed Zeno, like maybe this is my wife, this is my baby, or something like that. Babo, I think, is like maybe like baby.
Yeah, and I know in Spanish, Tio is uncle, and then Estas would be like this. I don't know. So maybe they're reusing some Spanish words in a different sort of with a different definition for whatever the Wreathian language is.
Anyway,
so I think maybe Tio is dad in this instance. Anyway, I think he's trying to talk to his dad and say, look, this is my baby.
Okay.
So that's what I get. I could be completely off base, but I think totally. That's, I mean, I think that makes sense to me.
Yeah, I hear you. I feel you. That makes a lot of sense. And, the last page of our entire reading, the two warriors take off their masks and we get Hazel's final narration. And then my grandparents came to live with us. And really cool. They are Marco's mom and dad. Marco's mom appears to have sort of like female goat horns and her father, his father, perhaps, maybe more like a gazelle or something like that. And him just saying, oh. And, you know, they've got really different expressions on their face.
Yeah.
His grandfather is sort of like wide-eyed and like, oh.
Maybe sort of surprised a little bit.
And then
she just does not look happy.
She looks mean. Now, she did just get hit by a heartbreaker.
That's true.
Maybe that has something to do with it, but it is kind of funny.
Yeah, and I guess maybe keeping in mind with the context. But still, she just not a happy camper one way or another right now.
And I tell you, you know, I think I mentioned earlier in the podcast or one of the other episodes that I really do feel that the series gets even better. And the grandparents are a big reason for that. I think the next volume and then even the third one, they figure in really good and they're great characters. Mm-hmm. What BKV does with them is super rewarding, really enjoyable, sort of emotionally moving at times. And so if this has been fun for you, let me tell you that the fun continues. This is an awesome comic, even in the next volume, just right. some really cool stuff. And the grandparents end up being a big part of that.
Yeah. And don't be surprised if at some point we do Saga Volume 2.
Absolutely.
So it's definitely not outside the realm of possibility.
That's right. Night of the Owls, Saga Volume 2. We'll come back to the ones we love. You know, a couple episodes back, I sort of touched on like some of the tropes of like hero stories and myths and fantasy without really taking a closer look at it. And so very briefly here, I'd like to sort of mention a couple of those. You know, these are elements, character types, things that we commonly see in mm-hmm. a lot of these fantasy sci-fi hero stories without getting too much into it. I just want to mention a couple.
Sure.
Certainly, they are on a quest. They yes. have this map. They have a destination to escape. The map itself, this is a very much X marks the spot kind of fun thing. Marco's reluctance to use violence as mm-hmm. a hero. I think that's a common theme in a lot of these stories. And the sacrifice, he needs to put down his sword for them to ultimately escape. Just the fact that Marco and Elena are two lovers from warring factions. I mean, Romeo and Juliet, hello. These right. are like not crazy things. You had touched on the fantasy versus science fiction, the technology, I think even in issue one,
yeah.
that they were sort of opposed. But not only are they opposed at times in the stories, but sometimes they're blended. I mean, in this issue, the rocket ship Treehouse, it both has these sort of organic and technical aspects to it. It is a functioning rocket ship that's made out of wood, like totally crazy. Robots are one of the biggest themes in a lot of science fiction literature,
right.
certainly magic and fantasy. They have different races, and just like Tolkien or, you know, Star Wars or Dune, like a lot of those are just obvious and they don't seem weird to us. Mm. But these really are elements that are, you know, through a lot of these stories. So I just wanted to touch on that. And then I wanted to look at two of our sort of villains very briefly. Anti-heroes in our story, starting with the Will.
Right.
There's a lot to like about the Will.
There is.
You know, clearly he has his own sense of morality, what's right and wrong. He's willing to murder, but he will murder a pederast. He will fight child abuse.
Right.
He's going on his own quest, which is, you know, filled with bumps and turns, but ultimately his quest puts him at odds with Elena and Marco. And I think it builds up suspense. It's exciting because you like the Will. You want to see him succeed, but his success will come at the expense of characters we also love.
Yes.
And then Lion Cat. Like, Lion Cat is not the Will, but Lion Cat is just straight up awesome.
Right.
Really cool design, really cool character. Plus, I can't help but trust the Will more than I usually would, as he seems to have a lie detector with him at all times. So, like, not only could Lion Cat call out boldface lies, but some of the time they do this in the book where the Will makes the throwaway comment and the Lion Cat points it out. And it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But I think, does the Will know himself better than the average person would know themselves?
Possibly, just maybe just by virtue of having Lion Cat around right, so much.
Totally. So the Lion Cat, I mean,
if he's having some sort of open dialogue with himself or even talking directly to Lion Cat, you know, even if he doesn't know that he's lying to himself,
right.
Lion Cat can just call him out on it. Like, right. No, you're not being completely honest with yourself.
100%, dude. 100%. And so I feel like the Will is perhaps more genuine with himself and whatever than other characters would
yes.
typically be. Can you imagine what it would be like to go through your daily life with a lie detector? Like, literally all the time. Like, that's kind of crazy.
It is. It really is.
Anyway, the point is, I find the Will extremely likable. But you can't get past the fact that his mission is to kill Elena and Marco and kidnap Hazel.
Right. It's hard to you can certainly root for him in some circumstances. I think with Slave Girl, possibly maybe with even like rekindling his relationship with the Stalk, maybe yeah. kind of because you see that it does bother him.
Yeah.
You know what's happened to him in the past, so maybe you want that. But then at the same time, you know, this sort of ultimate goal that he has. You know, as supporters of Elena and Marco, obviously
yeah.
those two are our main protagonists in the story right now. It's hard to support him 100% in everything that he does. Right. But there are certain, he is one of those characters that sort of exemplifies this point that life isn't black and white, that there's a ton of gray.
That's right. There, as a reader, I am conflicted when it comes to the will. Uh-huh. You know. The other character I mention is Prince Robot 4. And a lot of the same stuff can be said, you know, talking about families. I mean, he is a combat veteran with PTSD who just found out his wife is pregnant.
Yes.
Like, he is dealing with bouts of violence and anger that he has difficulty controlling. He has a family he wants to be with. He's been in some horrific battles. Mm-hmm. It's hard not to sympathize with him. Now, I think it's a little bit easier to be against him, but he's not quite as likable as the Will for a couple of factors. Yeah. One, he doesn't have a lion cat.
Right.
If he had his own lion cat, that would probably fit in. He is more alien looking. Yes. I mean, I know he's a robot, but just different looking with the TV head. And I think the Will is just like an attractive dude. He looks normal. It's easier to like him.
You know, early on, I almost considered the Will maybe sort of a Han Solo type character,
absolutely,
even with Lion Cat being sort of his,
absolutely,
Chewbacca.
Dude, 100%. Then, you know, even throwing in the Lion Cat, Chewbacca, yes.
Yeah.
Dude, totally.
And then, you know, Prince Robot, maybe, you know, not having the exact same motives, but sort of a Darth Vader type character, just as far as, you know, the electronics and not having a face that you can see instead of as a TV visor instead of a mask. You know,
absolutely. And although I can sympathize with Prince Robot, it's a little bit harder than the Will. We don't get those saving slave girl moments with him. And, you know, it might be a result of his PTSD, but he is a lot more inclined to get violent with people, you know, beating up the Rethian prisoner, just blasting a cap through the stalk. Very quickly, he did that without much conversation. He didn't look into it too deeply. Anyway, those are two. I think even the bad guys are kind of anti-heroes. There's stuff to support about them and like about them.
Absolutely.
I think it's one of the strengths of the story. You know, in comic books in general, I always hated when it was just like, take over the world, destroy the world. Yeah. That doesn't make sense to me as a real motivation.
But. You know what? One of the things I love most about, you know, one of the most infamous Marvel villains, Dr. Doom, is that he's not going out saying, I'm going to commit evil today.
Yeah.
He feels like in all of his dastardly deeds or whatever that he's saving mankind.
That's right.
So, and there was a great story. Gosh, what was it? Doom War? Maybe something like that from a year or two ago. There was something that happened in the plot line. I'm not remembering everything in exact detail, but there was some sort of this Egyptian ancient god that can apparently see into like the soul of a man and see if they are truly at their innermost core good.
Yeah, right. I remember talking about
that. Maybe not necessarily the means to their ends are good, but the ends themselves is a good end.
His intentions.
Yes, exactly. And this ancient god spirit type thing looked into Doom's soul and said that, yes, you are for a worthy cause.
Right. Right.
So to me, you know, this guy that's, you know, fought heroes left and right since the 60s or whatever, turns out deep down, he really does want what he believes is best for mankind.
That's awesome. As opposed to total black and white area. Pat, evil versus good, simple people to root for, people to root against.
Yeah.
I love this conflicted stuff where you do sympathize with the people whose intentions maybe or best cast or easiest cast as villainous.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very cool.
So I tend to, you know, when we're talking about some of these characters, I do tend to think back to Dr. Doom.
Yeah. So that's good. And then, you know, the letters page, I do want to touch on a couple of things here in our final Saga's letters page of To Be Continued, as it's called.
Yes.
Starts off with a little message from BKV in which he, you know, thanks the readers for making the comics a success. And we get a really cool tidbit here that he had a backup plan in case Saga was not successful and they had to end the arc after 6 issues. I'm gonna make sure I get it right. Here we go. If our book hadn't found an audience in its first 6 months, a distinct possibility for a new series in this treacherous marketplace, I told Fiona that we could have our heroes literally blow up on the launch pad in what would have been an awesomely depressing sixth and final chapter. Oh, so that was his backup storyline in some way that the tree was just going to blow up.
So if the numbers come in and they're not great, he can just hit the self-detonation button.
Just explode the damn thing. It spontaneously combusts, and it is its own kindling, I guess.
Right, you know? Right, exactly.
Sorry.
But even that's a clever idea, in a way. Yeah,
and I mean, it's sort of symbolism there. Even if it wasn't what he wanted, like, he probably could have made it happen in a cool way. He'd be like, oh, crazy man, this is so sad, you know.
Right.
As they jump to save, you know, Hazel and the explosion, they ride the force of the explosion in some awesome, epic Michael Bay kind of way.
Yeah.
I just said awesome and Michael Bay in the same sentence, by the way. Please forgive me. Anyway, so he touches on a couple of other things in this. He lets him know BKV and Staples have been taking breaks after each arc, which I think probably makes sense and help them keep on schedule.
Bunch of lazy slackers.
He announces a costume contest, which I hope you pick up the single issues. Remember that none of this is reprinted in the trade. So if any of this sounds cool to you, it's yet another reason to get the monthly. And you get a lot of really cool costumes. Obviously, there's some talented people out there. He does get military writers and writers from the great state of Utah to let them know that, no, all 50 states are reading. There's a little paragraph from one of the letters. I'm just going to skip into the letters now. Another one of these critical things that I enjoyed, and Kevin, I think you might have something interesting to say about this. This is Nick Zeromaditis. I'm going to go with that. Zeromaditis. Anyway, while the first issue displayed some shocking elements, I let them go since I tend to give each title more than one issue to pass full judgment on whether or not I will keep reading it or not. But four issues in, and I'm starting to wonder, is there a purpose to what you are showing us, or are you just trying to be shocking? If it's the latter, I'm afraid to say it comes out in poor taste. And this, Kevin, this is one of the things that you had told me initially, that you felt at times, at least upon your initial reading of Saga, you know, a year and a half ago or whatever it was, maybe 2 years now, geez. Anyway, that you felt some of the time that it was just shocking to be shocking. Do you still feel the same way? Do you?
Well, I think I did mention on an earlier issue that I think more so it was in volume two than volume one.
Okay.
But I think it is fair to say that there was some of that in volume one upon my first reading. And man, I didn't really pick up on it this time around. So I don't know if maybe I was just in like a kind of a more negative, cynical, mood when I was reading through it, because I did kind of get through it in just like, you know, one or two sittings or whatever. Because it is, you know, even I guess when I felt it was shocking just to be shocking, it still kept me turned in the page.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know. I think maybe you could probably see maybe some of it in some of the character designs a little bit, like
Sextillion.
Yeah, exactly. Things like that. I think one of the things that really I felt was just kind of shocking to be shocking does happen in volume two with a certain giant creature that we see.
Referred to that. I think you mentioned that you'd put it in your dining room.
Exactly. But with a good bit of exposure to the reader, they don't hold a lot back. A
giant amount of exposure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I guess depending on my mood, I can relate to this writer. And I think, you know, you can say that about a lot of things. How you react to certain subject matter does depend greatly on your mood. So I actually remember I read volume two in the parking lot of Davidson County Community College. I was out at DCCC before I went to started at UNCG.
Right.
Which I'm glad that you remembered, because for whatever reason, where do I go to college now? But anyway, so maybe I was going in like before a class I really wasn't looking forward to or something like that. Maybe that's when I was reading it. I don't know. But I do remember exactly where I was when I read volume two and liking it overall. But it did kind of come across with, you know, maybe some sort of,
extreme things that, that seemed extreme just for the sake of being extreme. Sure. You know what I mean? Sure. So maybe I was giving, you know, Brian K. Vaughan a little bit more crap than he deserved. Maybe there was something more to it. And if we get back to volume two and I read it through for a second time, like we've done volume one, I might feel differently. But who knows? Maybe it wasn't just the mood I was in. Maybe once we get to that point, I will, you know, bring up on some issues. This seems like a little bit much. This doesn't really seem to be helping the story all that much. And it seems like he's just throwing it out there to be sure. wacky. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Then again, it could have totally been just whatever mood I was in.
A lot of that matters. What mood you're in when you sit down and read something definitely sure. affects
you. You know, I mean, it's not just reading. It's the same thing for, you know, you definitely have to be in a certain mood to sit down and watch a Lord of the Rings movie. Right. You're investing yeah, yeah. 3 hours plus of your time if you're watching, you know, right, yeah. and a director's cut or whatever those special editions are, or music. You know, I don't want to listen to heavy metal first thing when I wake up in the morning. You know, maybe I want to hear some talk radio or maybe something a little bit smoother. You know, so mood is definitely a factor on how we take in different media.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Yeah. So. And, you know, just the context of us reading it for this podcast, for the discussion, I think, you know, there's things that I would write off that I'm a little more inclined because we're reading for this to sort of like look back at, see how well we really feel and, you know, just prepare to sort of talk about it with you that some of the time that very act influences our reading of stuff.
Yeah.
But,
absolutely.
We do get another winner and a final winner for our podcast
nice.
Of the, Almighty prize drawer, Hamburger K. Vaughan, makes his pick as usual. And I'm just going to read the letter because I think this guy knew what he was doing, or she knew what she were doing. Okay. She was doing Tiffany Navarro. Tiffany, you are very clever.
Dave Navarro's wife?
Yes.
Sister?
Yes.
Mom?
Guaranteed. That's right.
Okay.
Yes,
no, all three of those things.
Yes. Simultaneously. Ooh. Yes. It is not a branching it's family like, tree. And some man named Navarro or woman is going to come kick my butt for saying that. Anyway. Hi, BKV and team. I've never been interested in reading comic books, but I teach art to kids and I've noticed they love comic books. This Saturday, I decided to go to Forbidden Planet to check out the comic books and get some ideas for a comic book lesson for my kids. My friend was with me and he told me to check out Saga because he liked BKV's previous work.
Okay.
The cover art immediately got my attention and the art on the inside equally impressed me. I bought the book and I read it last night and I totally love it. The characters are likable and interesting. The location is unique and I wonder what sort of adventures will take place in it. Thank you for creating this book and I look forward to reading the next issues. P.S. I teach homeless teenagers. Do you know of any comic books they could relate to? And so Kevin, something immediately came to mind that was okay. so fitting that I was suspicious of this letter. Can you think of any BKV books that would appeal to homeless teenagers? Drum roll. Kevin and I haven't talked about this earlier, so I'm genuinely curious because I instantly thought of something. I was like, duh.
Is this specifically a Brian K. Vaughan
yeah.
book?
I know you're aware of it at least. You might not realize he wrote it, but.
Man, give me a second. Give me a second.
Homeless teenagers is your big slap in the face clue.
I know it's going to be super obvious once you tell me.
Runaways.
Runaways, yes.
Runaways.
Yep, the Marvel book.
It was,
yep.
like mutants, kids who are on the run or whatever. Yeah. And it was so, it just slapped me in the face. I was like, oh, you are lying. You are just trying to get free swag out of this nice man, you degenerate Tiffany Navarro. And so, of course, Runaways is among the things that Tiffany scores. Here, let's see it.
I can't believe that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't it just obvious in retrospect,
Runaways.
You know? So if this teaching homeless teenagers angle is just a cheap play for free comics, which yes, I think it is, it's one that my dachshund Hamburger K. Vaughan admires. That means you and your students will be getting several volumes of Runaways,
cool.
the all ages series I did with Adrian, Alfona, Christina Strain, and many more fine folks at Marvel, as well as some other wondrous clutter from the Almighty Prize Drawer. A monogrammed napkin pilfered from the restroom of Walt Disney's impenetrable Club 33. I don't know what that is. A voucher worth of 23 cents from Cleveland's mildly dispiriting Horseshoe Casino and a rare second printing of Saga Volume 4. And Bill here in the shop just perked up when I mentioned Walt Disney's impenetrable Club 33. What is that, dude?
It's a private club within Disneyland.
A private club within Disneyland. So apparently that... is an elite place. Members only. Okay.
Lunch and supper.
Yeah. Special knock door. Do you have like a pass you have to give, or do you have to like be wearing big ears? Yeah, secret handshake. Bill is confirming right now. That's crazy. And you do need big ears and four fingers on each hand. Very interesting.
The handshake
very
is something like.
That's right. That's right. Kevin, for those of you listening, is doing some extraordinarily esoteric, appropriate to the adult content of this podcast kind of gestures. Yeah. Anyway, so that's the final letters page. Oh my God. Really fun.
Ending I saga with this. A splash.
You do.
Not a bang.
Leave that up to your imagination. So this is the time when we would typically do our pick of the week,
yeah.
But we are doubling up this week to get Saga done because our plan is to do X-Men Days of Future Past in time for the release of the movie.
Yes.
And so we're doing an extra episode this week. Kevin and I were kind of running behind and I was like, dude, you just want to skip pick of the week? I'm not sure that I have a second one ready. And he was like, sure. And so I was like, awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So because keep in mind, this is actually a Monday we're recording on. So all we have to choose from are books that we already picked from on the previous episode. And this week's books aren't here yet. They don't come till tomorrow.
Although there is some super fly stuff coming out this week, including Saga, which is just totally fitting. And so new issue of Saga.
That's our pick of the week for this week. Yes. The new issue of Saga. Do you know what issue number?
I think it's 19.
Okay.
So there you go. That's a good call. That is our pick of the week. Saga 19.
Saga 19.
Released this Wednesday. I think the 23rd, maybe.
Pick up volumes, 1 through 3. I think there's three volumes out right now.
And I think volume one is like $1.99 on Comixology. So if you deign to read your actual loving works of art on a mechanical contraption of death and you enjoy that kind of thing, $2.
Yeah. And if you have a soul, you can come into Stormcrow Comics and pick up Saga Volume 1, the print version that
serving all soulful customers.
Won't glitch on you.
It won't crash.
If you drop this thing and somehow the book breaks, you don't lose your entire other collection of books. It's all still there, stored nicely away.
That's right. And you can pick up a trade paperback OtterBox for protection. That totally exists.
We've got some bubble wrap in the back. We can take some packing tape and get it all around your trade so you can't read it. At that point, think of it as like the poor man's CGC, but we'll make sure that it's protected for you.
That's right. And I also should note that we're sort of going to do Days of Future Past as one shot, just one episode devoted to. It's actually made of two different issues, but we're just going to handle them both at the same time. And next week we'll let you know. I think we were talking about was it Black Science with Matt? So we've got some ideas what we're going to do next.
Black Science is one. Superior Spider-Man we've been talking about. Yeah. So there's a few different ones.
But we'll let you know for the on the next episode exactly what the plan is.
A possible interview episode.
Yes. We've got something in the works there. So we'll see when we're able to nail it down. A special collector's item issue.
Yeah, where we interview Bill on the best strategy to infiltrate Club 33.
That's right.
Because I really want one of those exclusive lunches now.
Yeah.
It is 12:24 p.m. It is lunchtime, and I'm ready to go to Disneyland.
Correct. Yes.
So, but no, freaking Saga Volume 1. Fantastic storyline. Good stuff. I'm super happy we did it on the show. Like I said, I'm sure we'll revisit Saga at some point in the future. It's too good not to. To me, every bit as good as Scott Snyder's Batman run.
Yeah.
Although, of course, I do have a little bit more bias towards Batman. So if I had to pick between the two, I would still go Batman. But Saga, highly entertaining, really well written, well drawn, good quality comic book stuff. One of the best series being published right now.
Absolutely. So
I guess until next time when we talk to you about Days of Future Past, be sure to check out 336cast.com for previous episodes of Stormcrow Comic Cast, of other great podcasts on there. The Three Beards, Name Redacted, Opposed Thumbs, 336 Cast, Midnight's coming soon. I think there's actually two episodes now, so we're just waiting for that to get added to the network, and then they'll be on there. All that good stuff. The 336 Podcasting Network app for Android, you can find in the episode description on 336cast.com. Com for this episode. Just a link there. You click it. You can install right from where you're at on your Android device, and you're good to go as long as you have the Google Play app. So I think that's about it, right?
Dude.
That is. Well, thank you for doing this podcast.
Dude, thanks for doing the show with me. I guess we'll see you guys next week. Bye.